Greetings, folks. My name is Dr. Jamar Tisby. Welcome to another episode of Footnotes. Now, the way Footnotes began, if you are a longtime listener, we usually do like current events things, and I still love doing that. I'm going to give you hot takes every now and again, but I'm excited that in this iteration, I get to have on more guests and do more interviews, and that's exactly what you're getting today with my friend, John Ward. Welcome to Footnotes.
Dr. Tisby, it's good to see you. I did not call you Dr. Tisby when we first met, and so it's great to see you with that honorific.
I passed that milestone, and it will forever be there. Nobody can take it away. I'm glad for that. I want to give folks a quick introduction to who you are. This is straight from his bio. John Ward is a senior political correspondent for Yahoo News and author of Testimony: Inside the Evangelical Movement That Failed a Generation. That's what we're going to be talking about today. That's what brings him to the show today. That is forthcoming in April. You're going to hear more about it soon. But he's also the author of the book Camelot's End: Kennedy v. Carter and the Fight That Broke the Democratic Party. Now, that was published in 2019, but it's immediately relevant as we record this. It looks like Jimmy Carter, he's in hospice, looks like he's at the end of his life. So, John, have you had any contact with the family or President Carter since this latest development in his health?
I've been in touch with somebody down there who's close with the family just to send well wishes. And true to form, President Carter, you know, he went into hospice. It's been several weeks now, and he is still kicking. He is a stubborn man. And I say that mostly in praise of him because I admire him a lot. But if people don't want to, if they want to learn more about Jimmy Carter, there are some really good biographies out there. If people want to go really deep, Kai Bird and Jonathan Alter put out a biography of Carter in the last 5 years. But my book is a dual biography of Jimmy Carter and Ted Kennedy in the first third or half of the book. And so if you want to get your feet wet in a mini bio of Jimmy Carter, it's there in Camelot's End. Yeah.
Beautiful. And I'm a big fan of Substack. I have my own Substack also called Footnotes, but you have a Substack as well called Border Stalkers. So if they want to keep up with your work, I would invite you to subscribe to the Substack Border Stalkers with John Ward. So let's get into it. You've got this book coming out
April 18th.
April 18th. All right. April 18th. And I'm always interested in book titles. So this one's called Testimony: Inside the Evangelical Movement That Failed a Generation. Were there other titles in the running? What were some of those?
You know, for a long time, I just called the book Grown Up Evangelical, and I never really figured that would be the title. And then Testimony came to me at some point, and it worked. And then the subtitle was where we kind of did some work back and forth. And that came mostly from the publisher. And then I kind of tweaked it a little bit.
And that tells, it's a very accurate title, Testimony, because the format of this book isn't just like straightforward reporting. It's your testimony. It's your story, right?
The word actually came out as I was writing the introduction, because at some point in the introduction, I actually used that line. This is my testimony. Mm-hmm. That was when I kind of realized that would be a good title for the book. And the publisher liked it. So we kind of just went with it.
Absolutely. I'm glad you did. Thinking more about the title, you say, you know, Inside the Evangelical Movement That Failed a Generation. So we'll talk more about the movement part in just a second. Let's talk about the evangelical part. I'm a historian. There are never-ending, sometimes exhausting conversations or debates about what is an evangelical, how you describe them. And as exhausting as those conversations are, they're still pertinent. I mean, it's sort of this amorphous term that could be a lot of different things to a lot of different people, and maybe not a definition, but I'm curious, you know, how you would explain what an evangelical is.
I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with the Babington Quadrilateral, which is a set of not theological statements, but I don't know, would those be ecclesiological? I can't even say the word.
Ecclesiastical. How would you... theological statements, theological commitments, you could probably say.
Yeah, and I don't know all of them off the top of my head. I know that one of them is kind of biblical inerrancy. Another one would be proselytization or evangelism. So I would say that's one way to define an evangelical. And then I think over the last however many years, evangelicals as a term has really shifted away from something that's focused on either a set of theological concerns or a set of religious beliefs. And it's shifted towards just more of a political identity. And part of that is because of evangelicals themselves. Part of that is also because of probably the media and people who study religion, kind of talking about evangelicals through the lens of politics more often. So it's become more and more seen as like a voting block of generally cons politically conservative, Republican voting, largely white religious folks, I would say.
That's a pretty good description, certainly of its modern manifestation. I think that's helpful, and we'll get into a little bit of like the history, or your history at least, with evangelicalism that I think will flesh out the description some more. But just to park here on terms, on kind of definitions or descriptions, I'm always sort of contemplating the verbiage of evangelical or evangelicalism and fundamentalism. Historically, there was a difference. Evangelicalism sort of arose in the first third of the 20th century, kind of as a response to, these debates on evolution and science and the fundamentals, this whole set of books that pretty narrowly defined Christianity. And evangelical was supposed to be a sort of more outward facing, engaged with the culture, softer in some senses, form of Christianity that wasn't so dogmatic. Maybe it's changed. So I'm just wondering, from your perspective as a worker of words, do you think there is a difference between evangelical and fundamental, evangelicalism and fundamentalism? Today, how would you sort of use those terms differently, or are they kind of interchangeable?
Yeah, and these, as you're getting at, these terms are shifting over time. The evangelicalism you're just describing is kind of the evangelicalism of Billy Graham,
Exactly.
which was a response to the fundamentalist movement in a lot of ways. And I think it was Jerry Falwell Sr., even in the 70s and even maybe into the 80s, who I think did claim, I don't know when he stopped, to be fair, but at a certain point, I'm pretty sure he claimed the term fundamentalist, but then became part of the moral majority political movement and kind of shifted into that evangelical dimension. And fundamentalist can mean two quite different, not different things, but distinct things in terms of that religious movement where people self-identified as fundamentalists versus the way I would more generally use the term, which is a fundamentalist in my view, if I'm applying the term broadly, would be someone who probably has two major characteristics kind of at the foundation of everything. One would be like believing in literal truth of the Bible. And I've at times used the term hyperliteralism because, I think the whole debate over how you read the Bible is a really good one to have. And I don't want to cast dispersions on people who believe that every word is the literal word of God, and yet they interpret the Bible through its literary genre. I think that's kind of an interesting category of folks. They're interpreting Proverbs or Psalms as poems, but they think it's literally true in a way. I think that's an interesting, group. And then hyper-literalists would be somebody who read the Psalms or whatever part of the Bible they want to read this way and read it as, a direct command from God. That would be like hyper-literalism. So fundamentalist would be literal to hyper-literalist on the Bible, And then in general, their kind of worldview on life would be tending to be more binary, more black and white, either or, rather than somebody who's looking for nuance, trying to understand how things can be both and, and more comfortable with areas of gray and being unclear on some things.
Right. So then, and we'll get more into this, but the evangelical movement that you're talking about would definitely have some strong strains of fundamentalism, according to that sort of latter description that you gave. Yeah.
The broader, more general description of fundamentalism would certainly characterize many evangelicals. However, I think the strength of the term personally is that there are fundamentalists of that flavor in probably every point of view known to man. Mm-hmm. Because if you're taking your point of view and you're saying, I know I'm right, I know other people are wrong, and I don't really have much question about that, to me, that's a fundamentalist.
Yeah. Ooh, that indicts all of us in some way, shape, or form, or all of our communities. So you talk about in the subtitle, the evangelical movement. Describe that movement. What are you talking about? You know, the churches, the time period, the whatever of this movement.
So the movement that failed a generation, that subtitle clearly demarcates a period in time and in a specific generation, which would be, generally speaking, my generation. I'm in my mid 40s, born in 1977. My parents started a church with some friends in the 70s. It began as a Bible study and then became a church. And then they planted other churches and they had a group of several dozen churches in the US and in other countries. I don't know if it's fair to call it a denomination. Probably not. It probably wasn't that significant, but maybe a mini denomination. I don't even know what the scale is needed to become a denomination.
Right.
And where they were coming from was a rejection of the mainline Protestant denominations and sort of traditional Catholic church from that post-World War II era. They were also, even though they were coming out of the 60s and the hippie movement and had a lot of characteristics of the hippie movement, they were also reacting against parts of the hippie movement too, because there was a feeling of, you know, disappointment, I think, with parts of the free love ethos of the 60s. And certainly at the end of the 60s and into the early 70s, American life is pretty unsettled. And people are increasingly disturbed about the state of the country. You have all of the racial unrest in the late 60s. You have the assassination of Martin Luther King in 1968, the assassination of Bobby Kennedy in 1968. And the escalation of the Vietnam War. So there's a lot of things happening during this period that, while my parents' generation, you know, my parents were both born in 1953. And so they kind of came in at the tail end of the 60s. And they were looking, they were coming out of that. They were influenced by it, but they were also looking for more stability. And so they incorporated parts of hippie culture with this new kind of move of Christianity, which was called the Jesus movement. There's a movie out right now called The Jesus Revolution, which praised some of that. And so they had these Bible studies. They were caught up in something very, very significant and impactful in their lives. And then they started a church. And then they all started getting married and having kids. And so my story kind of traces the evolution kind of from the late 70s to now of that movement.
So this is really like the Jesus movement people and the outgrowth as they get a bit more organized, starting churches, starting this network of churches. And that's really sort of the trail and the strain of evangelicalism that you follow as you give your own personal testimony. So you grew up in a large family, and you were the son of a pastor, and you were heavily involved in church life. One of the ways that you describe that world is by saying certainty disguised as faith, it turns out, can take people to some bizarre places. Can you unpack that quote and maybe give us a story or two from your testimony that led you to you know, saying something like that? It leads you to bizarre places.
Yeah, I mean, probably the best example from my upbringing would be the way that people took things like the idea of prophecy or words of knowledge or God speaking to them. And this could have been a church leader, like a pastor, or it could have been a lay member, but there was a lot of room to kind of feel a sensation or think a thought and then interpret that as God speaking to you. Mm. I'm not here to say that God wasn't speaking to those people. I don't know. But neither did they. And so there was an over eagerness, I think, to assume that God was speaking to all of these people, especially the leaders. And the thing to me about faith that makes it faith is that you can't know for, you need faith to believe in things that you can't know for sure, that you can't prove. And so where it gets tricky is when people are taking things that they actually don't know for sure, seizing onto them by faith, but then having a certainty about them that actually becomes something other than faith. Hmm. Because I think one of the key ingredients of faith is holding on to that sense of, I hope this is true. And I believe I have the gift of faith to believe that it's true. I can't prove that it's true. Hmm. And so I need to hold it with a bit of humility and to hold it lightly. And so that's how it would apply to my upbringing. And then I think when you transition that whole approach to knowledge into the political realm, it has unfortunate consequences because it leads people to take political positions, whether it's on their own intuition or on the advice of people they trust. And I think it leads people to not do their due diligence really applying scrutiny to their own position, whether that's on theology or whether it's on politics. And so I think that misapplication of faith, that taking faith out of the realm of faith into the realm of certainty, had bad consequences in church because people were given the ability to have too much power over other people by saying, God told me this. And it's had bad fruit in politics as well, because I think it's bred bad habits in a lot of evangelical culture of not really being deliberate and thorough, intentional about how we think about living out our faith in politics.
That is so interesting. The resonance is there. I was at a small dinner gathering of essentially concerned Christian citizens. And I mean that in the most positive way, not in like this sort of narrow-minded fundamentalist way. And they were talking about how many of their friends and relatives had just been sucked into like the Fox News vortex or similar outlets. And one of the things that one person there said is they so uncritically accept whatever they're hearing from these people just because they're these people or these voices that they trust, and they're not doing anything near fact checking or even cross checking the information with other news outlets or sources or things like that. And this idea of certainty, and you even describe it in your definition of fundamentalism, is just so central, I think, to how it failed a generation. Where it didn't breed inquiry, if you will, it didn't even make room for uncertainty.
The other element here is that there was something quite powerful about what my parents experienced in the 70s. Mm. And I've made this point elsewhere, but when you have a really a powerful experience that engages your emotions, gives you a lot of purpose in your life, infuses your identity with a higher sense of meaning. That can, like, I would say, and you're young.
Yeah.
I would say any experience like that, religious or not, at a young age, can create some real challenges later in life. I would even say any amount of like massive success could be comparable early in life, because you tend to assume one of two, or maybe both of these things, that you have a lot of the answers and you're smarter than other people, or that what worked then will work later on. And those two things can combine. I'm smarter. What worked before will work. So we're going to keep the same playbook over and over and over again.
Yeah.
That does not set you up to be adaptable as life comes at you.
And you talk about the insularity of the church community that you were in. So it's almost like a hermetically sealed from perspectives and people that would start to shake up that certainty in positive ways. So tell us about your life, just like in this really tight-knit community, to put it positively. How was it, this 360-degree consistent messaging, really?
I do think a lot of this goes back to some priors, which, like, the unsaid sort of assumptions that feed into how you make your decisions. What I mean by that is, I think a lot of what shaped our church's mindset about the world outside of church was the Hal Lindsey book, The Late Great Planet Earth.
Yes.
And all of that left behind rapture based mentality about the end times. That was very popular in the 70s. I think Hal Lindsey's book sold, I'm not clear exactly on this, but I think it sold well over 1 million copies. And there were movies made about this then. There were then the Left Behind movies made and books written in the 90s, I think. And what that does is it creates a mindset of, okay, our job as Christians is to stay away from people who are not like us, who don't think like us, so that we won't be corrupted by them, and to just kind of wait it out until Christ comes back. To the degree that we do engage with people who are not like us, who are outside the church, it is to try to get them to think like us or become one of us by proselytization or conversion. And so that meant that our church life was all consuming. We went to church, obviously, on Sundays, but all of our relationships were with church members. We went to lots of meetings during the week. Any social gatherings would have been mostly with people from the church as well.
Yeah.
And I went to elementary school at a church, at a school run by the church. The only students at the school were children of church members.
Mm.
Everyone who taught at the school was a church member. Those were requirements.
Wow.
So this is a very closed system built around a cult of personality around the leader or leaders. It became one leader over time, C.J. Mahaney. And that has a lot of hallmarks of cultishness. And so it also allows for a lot of control over what people think and believe and how they act. For some of that, there was a lot of, I don't know how far we got into this thing called the shepherding movement. There was some of that that came into our church as well, where people were basically required to hand over control of major decisions to a counselor of some sort.
Yeah.
And that's just, I think we all know at this point, not all, but I think we know, like, that's not going to turn out well.
It sounds very colonial era Puritans. The church was the center of life and all up in your business in a way that probably didn't need to be. So you grow up in this environment, and then you talk about when you're about 20 years old, your radicalization. And I want people to understand, like, you were not tangentially involved in this movement. Like, you, for a season, we're all in. So tell us about this radicalization that you endured or went through.
Sure. And it's also important to point out to people that the early part of my life in church, growing up and as a young teenager and into my high school years, our church was pretty charismatic and our theology was probably a secondary concern. And the time that I became radicalized in college, we were taking a hard turn towards pretty severe Calvinism. And so I kind of experienced two major streams of evangelicalism, which are pretty different.
Yeah.
Both highly influential and play very different roles in American political life as well. And I use two leaders from these different streams as archetypes to kind of illustrate those stories. Mahaney being one, Lou Engle being another, who's kind of works with a guy named Cheyenne. They're part of the New Apostolic Reformation, which a lot of scholars have written about.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, around age 20, I am kind of flirting with partying and drinking and not really all that wild stuff. Like, I really had the fear of God drilled into me growing up, but I started to flirt with that sort of thing. And the church kind of, you know, started to recognize that in me and other people. They hired some people on staff to reel us back in, and they met with us, did Bible studies. And but I had a very, you know, intense religious experience. And for about 3 or 4 years, I was, as you said, all in. I became a small group leader. I became a teacher at the high school that the church ran. And so I literally at times, I think physically felt like at the tail end of those years that I was going to suffocate because there was just so much sameness and agreement. And I think constitutionally I get uncomfortable when everybody's saying the same thing anyway. I need there to be some dissenting voices around. And I think that's really, really important for all of us to have voices in our life that are saying things that are quite different than what we think. It keeps us honest, keeps us from radicalizing, you know? I was young, restless, and reformed, I guess.
I know that world well, absolutely.
Yes, you do.
When did things start to shift for you? So you said, you know, a period of about 3-4 years or so. Was there an event or a series of events that started to bring you to that place where it's like, I need these other voices? That feeling of suffocation that you described, was there something that helped you breathe more freely?
It was really just coming to the end of myself, because our church took the idea of all of us having in original sin extremely seriously. And I took my faith extremely seriously. And we had this culture of self-shaming over young men looking at pornography and masturbating. And we would meet in groups of young men and talk about this. Just not optimal. Not optimal.
Blind leading the blind.
And I write about that in the book. So anybody who wants to vicariously experience really uncomfortable meetings in Starbucks, that's your reason to go buy the book. but it really, by the end of the time there, I would have kind of done anything to get out of there. And I basically just told the guy overseeing the small groups, the pastor, I was like, I'm looking at too much porn. I can't stop. I can't be a leader anymore. You know?
You just turned it right back on them. You said, I know they'll cut me loose if I say this.
I mean, I really needed to get out. I knew it. But your question also asked me like something about when did I begin to shift or something like that. And I think another important, really important thing I'm trying to convey is that while I went through a transition at that time of burning out on this intense religion and moving out of this very closed loop of relationships and life, overall in my life, my transition into a different way of thinking about faith and a different way of applying faith to politics has been a very, very long process. And I do think that's really important to stress, because I think it's important in two ways. Again, generally, if we know somebody else who we love and we want to see them grow and evolve in any direction or in any way that we think is more healthy, no matter what that world is or worldview they're coming from, it's going to take time. It's going to take a lot of patience. It's going to take us loving them more than trying to tell them how they're wrong. And then I think the second reason it's important is because for somebody who's not grown up in a faith setting like this, I think it's important to understand how, if, especially for people who are raised in this, in these kinds of environments, the indoctrination is very deep and it takes a very long time. Not, I'm not saying that anybody should reject it all. I'm just saying it takes a very long time to think through your own set of beliefs and thoughts on things. It's not something that just happens overnight. Cause you know what? We're all busy. We're all living lives. We're all trying to pay the bills and move our careers along and care for our loved ones. And so that takes up a lot of time too. So very few people have the time to just read books all day or whatever. Yeah.
I feel indicted as a professor.
Oh no, I wasn't even saying that about you.
Professor with you. I don't have, I have time a lot of time to read books all day. I am so intrigued by this statement you write. Journalism has made me more of a Christian, a better Christian. So I'd love for you to talk about why that is, or how you think journalism has impacted your faith. But then I also want to talk about other journalists and how you see, you know, I get the impression that there are a lot of journalists with a faith background and maybe even an evangelical one, but they're not nearly as willing to talk about it as you have. So I'm just curious about your thoughts on the state of faith in journalists and journalism.
Yeah. When I say that Christianity made me, or journalism made me a better Christian, I'm referring back in a lot of what I'm saying is referring back to those habits of mind that I talked, that we talked about at the very beginning. This sense of certainty without knowledge, which is also a lack of discernment. Journalism has trained me in how to exercise discernment. And it's trained me in how to go out and search for wisdom and knowledge, as my father taught me when he read me the Proverbs. And those, that was an one of the amazing things about working on any kind of book like this, is you piece together your past and make connections, and things emerge that you didn't see were there. And I saw that the way that my dad read the Proverbs to me every day, almost, and those verses from the first few chapters of Proverbs about seeking wisdom, and though it costs all you have, get understanding, I have begun to see, like, those things stuck with me and are part of the reason why I've come into conflict with my parents and many people like him, is because I've taken it to heart. Not that they haven't, I'm not trying to say that, but yeah, I'm losing the thread here though. What was the original question?
Yeah, no, that just unpacking that quote, and I love the way you said it made you get better at discernment. And this is just my thing, is I look very closely at the way journalists sort of cover religion, especially evangelicalism and things in that world. And what I'm discovering is a lot of journalists have some sort of faith background, either in their past or something that they're practicing now, but there's very few that would talk about it, let alone write a book about it. And I'm wondering if you see the same thing, or what kind of is, in your view, how you've experienced other journalists in relation to their own kind of faith journey.
Yeah, and I'm cognizant of the fact that you were just recently at the Faith Angle Forum, which may have played some role in this. Which
that's
is
right. Great. That's right.
I'm on the advisory council of the Faith Angle Forum, and Josh Good, who runs that institution, is doing a great job. And I would say that's one of the vehicles that's helped me come to some of the same realizations that you have. There's also a group of, I would say, 20 or so journalists who, most of them have no connection to the Faith Angle Forum, tend to be younger, who are all from some Christian background or another, active faith life, who are kind of getting together semi-regular basis. And I think your observation is correct that a lot of, and there's people who I work with at Yahoo who come from a very, very devout faith background. So yeah, I think you're right that there is a reticence to sort of put it out there. There are people at places like the Dispatch, places that lean right. Yeah. Obviously people at like Turning Point USA kind of use faith as, trying to be charitable here. It just seems like more of an in-your-face thing. We'll just say that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to judge their motives, but it's definitely in your face. And then there's places like the Dispatch where I think people feel a little more flexibility. And then there's places, I think in the mainstream space, there's less openness about that. So yeah. Actually, as we're talking, I do hope that like my book encourages other people to talk about it more. And I do sense that there is more willingness to do that. I think media institutions are realizing that they need to explore this space more. I think you look at the New York Times, the amount of moderate, conservative, Christian and religious figures that they've brought on to write mostly opinion, because that is where you're going to get more identification of sort of belief system or point of view. But I could rattle off five or six right now. I mean, David French, Esau Kali, Tish Warren. They've also hired more religion reporters, Liz Diaz, Liz Brunig, and others. So I think the Times is a clear example of a realization that this needs to be more of a focus. I think another factor might be just a perception that putting yourself out there as a Christian is seen as proselytizing.
Right.
And I can identify with that. I have to say, as a reporter, I've never wanted to go out and say, I am X, Y, Z, and the other thing. I just wanted to go out and report as fairly as possible and not put myself in a position of advocating for any one view. So those are some of the factors that go into that, I think.
No, that is a phenomenally helpful answer. Are you at all, did you give any thought about how writing this book and being open about your journey, whether that would affect you professionally at all?
Yeah, I've thought about that.
Mm-hmm. My hope is that what you said is exactly what happens, and that it sort of opens a doorway for other journalists to talk more openly about it, because it's part of their background. We all have a perspective, even when we're doing, just straight reporting, right? So that's my hope for the book. But I do, appreciate your courage as a journalist putting this book into the world. One of the things that you said earlier, it brings up a constant debate I have with myself. So you were talking about how helpful it has been for you to have voices in your life with different viewpoints, even that you might disagree with. And of course, there are real world applications around that. But let's take it to Star Wars. And I'm thinking about like the Rebel Alliance. We are it's the way the story is told. We are given the message that the rebel cause is the righteous cause, right? So I mean, in that sort of scenario, right, where you're pursuing justice, you're pursuing love of neighbor, what does it look like to have like dissenting voices? Because immediately when you say that, in our world, my mind goes to, well, I need more like Republicans or Trumpers in my life. I mean, how do you explain or parse that?
Well, a distinction that often gets lost is between relational or interpersonal and public and professional. Public professional is one setting, interpersonal relational is another. And I think the interpersonal relational space is one where there's more freedom and safety to engage in friendship with people who have different backgrounds and see the world differently and think different thoughts. And you're going to want to be looking for people who are also asking questions in good faith and looking for understanding and seeking to be curious as much as, and sometimes that can be hard to find. The thing about journalism that I think also ties back to how it's made me a better Christian is that it's given me an excuse or a passport or, a free excuse to seek people out and ask them questions.
Yep.
And you were part of that, back in 2017, I came to you with questions, came to others with questions as I was working. And there was an interaction between my public life and my personal, point of view. And then, if you are out there advocating for a set of principles or policies or outcomes or groups, that's just a different venue. It doesn't mean you can't engage in good faith debate or even engage in bad faith debate. Hopefully you're not in bad faith, but in debate with people who might not be in good faith.
Right.
I mean, that's just a different setting. I think what I'm mostly talking about is the work that we're doing on ourselves. But I do think institutionally, even, advocacy groups, and maybe that's going to be internal too, but to keep yourself sharp, you do want to engage with the best arguments that contravene where you're coming from. I mean, that's what lawyers do when they're preparing for arguments, if nothing else than to make their arguments better. I mean, to know your opponent's arguments makes your argument better. So it's a time and place thing. It's time and place is what came to mind when thinking about identifying as a Christian, as a journalist, because it's not appropriate for every journalist necessarily to do that.
Very wise, thoughtful responses. I appreciate it. As we sort of wrap up here, let's talk about more contemporary things. I mean, the elephant in the room in terms of how the evangelical movement failed a generation, I think a lot of people would look at Trump and Trumpism. And so there's obviously way too much to talk about around that. But as you are perceiving the landscape, what do you think Trump and Trumpism is teaching us? What lessons should we be attuned to as we see this incredible political support from evangelicals for this person and this movement more broadly? What are we gleaning from this era?
I don't know if you saw Tim Alberta's piece in The Atlantic about basically arguing that evangelical support for Trump is less locked in than it was the last two elections. He's got some reporting to indicate that might be true. I'm a little skeptical that it's not going to be the same. In other words, I think it's quite likely that we see similar levels of support for Trump from evangelicalism. I'm open to being wrong, obviously. Would like to be wrong. I think what it tells us is that a lot of evangelicalism, and I'm borrowing this language from Greg Thompson, is a cultural project disguised as a theological project. He might be borrowing that language from somebody else, but I think that was one of the big things that came out of the last several years, is a lot of things that seemed to be held up as moral, ethical, or religious principles, beliefs, or political positions were revealed as more just pragmatic, political, for the sake of power or self-preservation. Somebody like Hugh Hewitt, would argue that conservatives got the Supreme Court that they wanted, and so everything else was worth it because they've been able to get rid of Roe versus Wade. And I know people personally who believe some version of that. It's a somewhat oversimplified view, but that's the basic gist of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I acknowledge that they got the outcome on abortion law nationally that they wanted. My pushback, though, on abortion is that most of the time that people sold the Supreme Court as the be all end all. Their rhetoric was saying that abortion would be ended or outlawed. And of course, that's not the case now. Like, abortion is still legal in much of the country. So I think that reduces the argument's power to say we had all these costs from Trump, but we gained, you know, the victory over Roe, and abortion's over. Well, no, abortion's not over. So if you're anti-abortion in most or all cases, you actually didn't get all of the outcomes that you were promised, right, from Supreme Court. But I think going back to 2016, my basic point in the book is that it was pretty clear that Trump didn't care and or have much respect for the rule of law, our constitutional order, and democratic freedoms, or the notion of truth. And when I say truth, I mean just sort of observable, knowable truth. I'm not talking about ultimate truth or philosophical truth. And he pretty intentionally went after the idea that we could know truth by his kind of intentional assault on reality. I mean, his claim that, you know, there were more people at his inauguration than Obama's, I think that's the way he put it. But, you know, there was clear photographic evidence that there were, that what he was saying was not true. And there was just sort of intentional, obvious, provably false lie after lie like that. And then you get into the 2020 election and he's lying day after day after day in ways that are, again, that are provably false about election fraud and voting by mail and all these things. So I think January 6th kind of made it pretty clear that all of his disregard for our democratic order and the freedoms that protect our ability to advocate for whatever cause we care about, his disregard for all that was quite actionable on his part. And so I think, given all that, the role of a faith group in response to somebody like that who says, "I'll protect you," should be to rely on their faith rather than on the political figure. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of people relied on the political figure rather than on testing the reality of their faith claims. So I think that just exposed a lot of evangelical political engagement as driven by pragmatism and self-preservation.
Well, I can say from personal interaction that you're someone who really lives out this idea of being genuinely curious, open to changing your thoughts, and just as importantly, open to living out your faith and your belief with integrity. So I am very grateful for the gift of this book, Testimony, that you've given us, which tells us so much about you and your life, as well as about this broader evangelical movement. Book is out April 18th, 2023. It's available for pre-order now wherever books are sold. If you want to find out more about the book, go to John Ward Writes, J-O-N, johnwardwrites.org, and you can find out more information there. John, I'm really excited for this book to be in the world, and thank you so much for coming on Footnotes to tell us about it. We appreciate you.
Yeah, Jamar, thank you for that. I really appreciate you a lot, and I see you as a fellow traveler on that same quest for honest, authentic faith, and just, you know, seeking reality, seeking ultimate reality, and seeking reality in general. And so I'm privileged to be on the road with you.
Thank you, sir. Best for your book launch, and many, many people reading it and being changed by it. We'll talk to you soon.